A 50-year conflict in India has come to an end with the surrender of the Maoists, who at their height controlled a vast tract of the country, from near the Himalayas down to the centre of India itself. The capitulation of the Maoists over the last year means more than an end of decades of violence. It promises to unlock immense wealth in India. To discuss the rise and fall of the Maoists, we're joined by Rahul Pandita, a distinguished New Delhi-based journalist who has reported the Maoist insurgency for many years and wrote the book Hello Bastar, The Untold Story of India's Maoist Movement. Rahul, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Rahul, where did the Maoists come from? There had always been a communist party in India.
Well, the history of the Maoist movement in India will have to be divided into two chapters. So the first insurrection began in India in the 60s. It was led by erstwhile members of India's mainstream Communist Party who got disillusioned with their organization and they felt that the Communist Party had moved away from the concerns and welfare of the poor and the marginalized they claimed to represent. And we must remember it was a very vibrant and tumultuous time at the same time across the world. So a group of communists got inspired by Chairman Mao in China, and then they started this rebellion in a small hamlet in India, in eastern India, along the Nepal border. The first chapter of the Maoist movement in India is called Naxalbari because it started from a village called Naxalbari. So the Maoists in India are often referred to as Naxals, which is a name taken from that village.
Right.
And it inspired a lot of young students and other young people in those days. And many young students from India's most elite institutions left their education, left their college and universities, and joined the movement. But the movement came to naught in a matter of just a few years because beyond the concept of class annihilation, which meant that many youngsters would just roam around with a knife or a country-made, very crude pistol and kill a lone policeman standing somewhere on a street in Calcutta in East India, it did not achieve much. And the then Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, launched a state force against the Maoists. And by the early 70s, the movement was contained.
So, Rahul, how long had that part of the movement lasted? How many years are we talking about?
So about 5 to 7 years.
And it was just sort of random violence that really didn't achieve any kind of political change.
Well, it inspired a lot of people and, it brought forth the question of the marginalization and poverty of a large number of Indians, a majority of Indians, if I may say so. And this is something which a young Indian revolutionary called Bhagat Singh, he had warned about this at the age of 23, just before he was hanged by the British in 1931. In a letter, he writes to the young political workers a month before his hanging. He basically makes them aware of the fact that the sheer transfer of power from the British to a small section of powerful people in India may not achieve much for the poor. And that's exactly what happened. The country's first prime minister was Mr. Jawaharlal Nehru, and no one can doubt his commitment to social justice, etc. But too much remained to be done. Land reforms took place, but it could not break the feudal concentrations of wealth and power.
Rahul, from your work, I've taken some of the figures, which are truly astonishing. A national sample survey in 2013, so that's only 12 years ago, that 7% of the landowners in India own half the land in India.
Yes, it's true.
So the feudal structure that the British had protected while India was a colonial possession remains largely intact, or am I not acknowledging enough change? But certainly a great deal for a communist party to get their teeth into.
A lot of changes have happened since then. You know, so it's a question of, I mean, it's really a question of glass half full and half empty. But you know, at the same time, the lives of many poor people in India has changed now. And it has changed rapidly since the economic liberalization of the 90s. But it has also brought its own challenges now. Challenges in the sense that, you know, the figures you speak about, many in India fear that most of the resources, most of the wealth, is concentrated in the hands of a few wealthy business families. Many fear that, you know, we are a parliamentary democracy, but we are in spirit, and that's what many people feel here, an oligarchy where, you know, the power is rested in the hands of a few select lord.
Now, Rahul, I've jumped the story forward because we were talking about the first stage of the Maoist movement, but then comes the second stage. Tell us about the second stage of the movement.
The second stage began somewhere right after the first stage was over. It started in a, you know, completely different place in southern India, in the state of Andhra Pradesh, where a former associate of Charu Majumdar, who was the main leader of the Maoist insurrection 1.0, he made some changes in the Naxal line of the 60s. And from there, the Maoist grew in strength till we reached a point in the mid-2000s when two communist parties, Maoist parties, the People's War Group and the Maoist Communist Center, came together and formed an umbrella party called the CPM Maoist, which is Communist Party of India Maoist, which was formed in 2004. So their strength was in many ways doubled. And by this time, they had established what is called a rear base in central India, which is essentially home to India's indigenous people. We're talking about a thick Amazon-like dense jungle where there's an absolute vacuum left by the Indian state. And that vacuum was essentially filled over years by the Maoist guerrillas. And then the state went after them. But, you know, in the initial years, it could not achieve much because the Maoists had the sympathy of the indigenous people and the other marginalized communities living in this area. But from 2010 onwards, a lot of development has happened in these places. So a lot of the government, because it wanted to send its state forces, it has worked a lot on road mobility, mobile networks, connection, etc. A lot of some of the development has happened in this area. And now under the BJP government in the last couple of years, there's been absolute onslaught where the Union Home Minister has said that, you know, we have to bring Maoism to its knees. And something dramatic has happened in the last couple of years in the sense that suddenly a moment which the erstwhile Prime Minister, Mr. Manmohan Singh, called India's biggest internal security threat as recently as in 2009, is almost over in a matter of couple of years.
Now, Rahul, let's go back a bit because I want to talk about the Maoists at their height. What were the Maoist strategies? Were they violent? Was the kidnapping? Was the killing? How did they actually operate?
So this communist leader who sort of started Maoist 2.0, a man called Kondapalli Sidaramaiah, he's popularly known as KS in Maoist circles, he made two changes in the line of Charu Majumdar, who was the first leader. The first change was establishing this rear base, which I talked about. The other change was the creation of overground organizations, something which Charu Majumdar failed to do. So through these overground organizations, which attracted a lot of youth in Andhra Pradesh and many states, so these students basically then became Maoists between 75 and 80. And these are the ideologically driven men and women who then entered this forest area, which I'm talking about, which the Maoists call Dandakaranya in central and eastern India. It's a long contiguous area, if I may say so, which it's like an arc from Nepal's border with India till southern part of India.
Sort of cutting India in two.
Well, you know, there was a time when they had influence over almost one-fourth of India's territory, about 120 to 150 districts out of odd 660 districts in India. So what they did is they started training a lot of indigenous people here, and they created this guerrilla base in many, many areas. And then they were, in the initial years, they were trained by a ragtag group which owed its allegiance to the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, the LTTE. So the biggest strength of LTTE was in laying improvised explosive device, which is a training which was imparted very well to the Maoist guerrillas. And they did a lot of damage to security forces who would go after them. There's this one incident which happens in 2010 in which 75 policemen are killed, which is the biggest number of casualty in any of insurgency in post 1947 India. So a big challenge.
Tell us about your contact with the Maoists and how you came to have that contact and what you discovered when you came to know them and talk to them.
Well, you know, I had a personal history of dealing with insurgency in India. I come from the northern state of Jammu and Kashmir, which is the only Muslim majority state in otherwise Hindu majority India. And in 1990, my community, the Kashmiri Hindus, were driven out of the state by Islamist extremists. And it strangely did not get the kind of traction or the press media coverage or the coverage of the international community the way it should have been. So it made me think about larger issues. And when I was in college, I came in touch with some people who came from a leftist point of view. And right after college, I got an opportunity to travel through the hinterland in many areas where the Maoist guerrillas were active. And it exposed me to the Indian heartland for the first time. Before that, I had hardly any exposure about how the majority of Indians lived. And it changed my own perception about many, many things. And I came to realize that my own pain, my own suffering was, I mean, though significant, it was just a tiny percentage of what a large number of Indians were going through. It is around that time that I kind of established a contact with the Maoist guerrillas, and I began traveling in those areas. And of course, when you're traveling in those areas, in those times, the security scenario in those areas was lax. You know, it did not have that kind of security which we are witnessing now. Yeah. So it was relatively easier to travel without invoking any scrutiny from security forces. So I traveled a lot. I really got interested. I got curious about this area. And I started traveling. Of course, in those days, you know, the movement was very nascent. And when one spoke to editors in New Delhi about the fact that this was something which would turn very big, they hardly paid attention to it. But of course, in just a matter of few years, it became what it did. And then it evoked a lot of attention.
And so you were covering it and writing stories about it from that nascent time as it rose to greater significance.
Yes, indeed, David.
Yeah. So the Indian government never sent troops in to try and sort of clear them out. What was the response of the Indian government to this movement, which was sitting on a lot of land?
It was extremely difficult to send troops. You know, this is an extremely difficult area. Till recently, the Indian forces did not even have proper maps of these areas. And like I said, you know, this is an Amazon-like dense jungle where the security forces were dealing with too much. You know, the weather conditions are very harsh. In summer, the temperature rises up to almost 50 degrees. Humidity is terrible. Your biggest enemy in this area is malaria, which is endemic in this area. And then, of course, you do not know the local language. You do not have the kind of motivation which the Maoist guerrillas have, and you do not have the kind of sympathy which the Maoist guerrillas have. So in the initial years, for many, many years, these security forces which New Delhi sent in this area would just land into trap laid by Maoist guerrillas, because they were very meticulous with ambushes. You know, they had military manuals which the Viet Cong used against the US in the 60s in Vietnam.
Oh, right.
They used that, you know, the guerrilla warfare, basics of guerrilla warfare. So the Indian forces could not match that, really. That is why a number of casualties took place. But gradually, of course, the Indian forces also learned from their experience. And like I said, a separate force was raised from the indigenous people, which comprised of local people and, of course, a number of surrendered Maoists who were given a lot of money. So they started making inroads in these areas. But initially, in the initial years, the security for the Indian security forces faced a lot of casualties.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Rahul Pandita, journalist who has covered the Maoist insurgency in India for many years, an insurgency which has now come to an end. Rahul, was it underneath this jungle that a number of very valuable minerals are to be found? Is that what the Maoists were sitting on? A great wealth, a great mineral wealth?
So when I try and explain this to an outsider, I have a very simple formula. I say, take a map of India which shows its natural resources, which shows area which has its maximum natural resources. And we're talking about things like iron ore, coal deposits, bauxite, and what is called NTFP or non-timber forest produce. You have things like tamarind, for example, in the Maoist guerrilla zone, which is extremely costly, and it's imported, I believe, to about 70 countries from India. And then you take another map of India, which shows its extremely poverty-affected regions. And then you take another map of India, which shows areas where the Maoist guerrillas are. And if you kind of juxtapose these three maps, you will be surprised to know that these three maps will show you the same area. This is something which the Maoists knew really very well. I remember in 2007, a senior Maoist leader was arrested, and he was a contemporary of Charu Majumdar. And I've read his interrogation reports, and he tells his interrogator at one point in time during in the interrogation, he says, and I'm just quoting him, he says, his name is Sushil Roy, and he says, "Forest means minerals. Minerals means money. Money means guns. And guns means power." So even the Maoists were very aware of the fact that the territory which they were controlling had immense resources. And in a way, they had promised the indigenous people that these resources, the land and the resources beneath them, they'll fight for the protection of these resources.
And they would belong to the people.
Yes. But I think at some point in time, they lost their plot. You know, they became more obsessed with fighting the state. And of course, they started taking cuts. They became a stakeholder in these natural resources in many ways. And this is what has finally led to their downfall.
You spoke before that the Indian state put a huge investment into opening up these areas and recruiting locals to fight the Maoists. When did that operation begin, and how successful has it been?
It began in around 2010 under Mr. Manmohan Singh, and it was something spearheaded by the then Union Home Minister of India, a man called Mr. P. Chidambaram. They started an operation called Operation Green Hunt, which is essentially sending a lot of security forces into this area and, you know, building this road network and mobile networks, which I was talking to you about. But I think this government, which came in 2014, it has essentially focused on the area in the last couple of years. I would say in the post-COVID area, it has started getting a lot of results. But these results are a result of what I was talking about earlier, this strange estrangement between the indigenous people and the Maoist guerrillas, because the more the security forces began, the Indian state began its push in the erstwhile Maoist areas, the Maoist guerrillas became more paranoid, and they started killing more and more indigenous people on the suspicion of being police informers.
Right.
So it created a lot of hatred against them in many, many areas, I would say. And coupled with this, you know, development of road networks, mobile networks. Let's imagine if you are a police informer in a village and a Maoist guerrilla, a leader has come to your house, a hamlet, but you have no way of telling the police about this because there is no mobile network. But suddenly you have mobile network now. And it's just a matter of, you know, you just have to dial a number and the police will be there in no time and the Maoist guerrilla will be killed. So these are the changes that have happened in the last couple of years, especially in the last couple of years, which has led to their downfall.
When did they start surrendering? I understand that process actually still continuing, but when did they begin to acknowledge that they had lost and how did they surrender?
I think the real acknowledgement has come in the last 1 year, if I may say so. When suddenly the state forces started getting a lot of results and a lot of their central committee and Politburo members were either killed or they began to surrender. We have, you know, in the last few months seen a spate of surrenders, including in October of a very, very senior Maoist commander called Sonu, who was among the first squads who entered Dandakaranya in the June of 1980. So most of these surrenders and killings have happened in the last few months. I think what has happened now is that the police have kind of made major inroads as far as intelligence is concerned. I think they have intelligence among the Maoist cadres now, especially in some companies of the Maoists who are responsible for the security of the leaders. I think they've made inroads in those companies among those bodyguards who have given information about the whereabouts of the leaders, and then the state forces have gone and killed those leaders.
Rahul.
So I think it's pretty much, you know, if you really ask me, the moment is pretty much over.
Right. But those surrenders have been accompanied by apologies from the Maoists. Now, what's that about? Who are they apologizing to? And for what?
So I think, you know, the apology came from Commander Sonu, who I was talking to you about. He surrendered in October. So I think by this time, it was clear to Sonu that they had failed in achieving their target. So what Sonu does is he addresses a letter to his comrades and he addresses a letter to the people they were supposed to represent. And he apologizes in that letter, basically saying that, you know, they have strayed from their goals, etc. So that was the crux of that leader. But after that surrender, you know, Sonu's elder brother was also a very senior Maoist commander, a very efficient Maoist commander, if I may say so. He was killed in an encounter in 2011. People like Sonu and Kishanji, you know, they're very difficult to replace because, you know, they came from that commitment and motivation and that ideological training, which is very rare to find among the new Maoist guerrillas. So it created a schism in the Maoist ranks and files, in the sense that, you know, the many overground Maoist sympathizers are now calling him a traitor. But, yes, you know, he's a practical man. He has spent decades and decades inside. In my view, you cannot call him a traitor. He has given his entire youth to the Maoist movement. Good or bad, you know, that is debatable. But he's given his youth to something he truly believed in. But he's also a practical man. He has seen the downfall in front of his eyes. And he has just sought it right to surrender in front of the state forces. And that is what he has done.
Rahul, how is this going to change India?
I wish I could answer that, David. Now, you know, for decades, the Indian government, successive Indian government, it's not a question of this government or that government. New Delhi has used insurgency as an excuse for misgovernance, saying that, oh, you know, there are insurgents in this area, there are Maoist guerrillas, we cannot bring in development. So now that the Maoist movement is over, many of us are hoping that now some development will happen in this area. But there are civil rights activists in this country who fear that that development might not take place, and it's just a ruse for you know, these corporates to go and usurp this land and the natural resources beneath it. But I'm hoping that as someone who's a well-wisher of this area and who's a well-wisher of the people in this area, I sincerely hope that some sort of development and some sort of progress happens in this area, because the indigenous people, these poor people, were caught in this war between the Indian state and the Maoist guerrillas. And they need peace, they need progress, they need education, they need basic healthcare, like all the people in the world deserve it.
Rahul, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Rahul Pandita, distinguished journalist in New Delhi, who has been reporting on the Maoist insurgency for many years and who has just published his first novel, Our Friends in Good Houses, published by HarperCollins, and the notices have been good. This is Late Night Live.